And then I will go ahead and put you all on mute. Okay, so everyone is on mute now except Ali and myself. So Ali, you can still hear me, is that correct?
Yes, I can still hear you.
Okay, great. And then everybody else, I'm going to take you off mute in a second. I just want to get the confirmation from you. All right, you're off mute now. Can y'all still hear me?
Yes.
All right, imagine that. Call conference technology is working. All right. So I just spoke with Ali for the last 30 minutes or so about the various questions that have been submitted. And we're going to jump right in because there's quite a few really good ones, and we want to get through them all. So what I'll do, put you back on mute here, and then what I'll do is I'll ask for the folks who submitted the questions. Once we're done answering them, I'll unmute everybody and see if you're out there. And see if we've addressed your question. And if you're not out there and you're just listening to the recording, we'll just move on from there. All right. So again, let me just say it's an honor to be working with you in this course. As I said in my last faculty response that I posted to the forum, and still, you know, which holds very true and is worth saying again here, I've been really just deeply impressed and deeply inspired with the quality of the work that y'all have been doing and with the passion that you're engaging this work, this course, and in particular, engaging each other. You know, the core intention for creating this online course pilot and for testing out this offering to see if we are going to offer it, you know, ongoingly in the future was simply based on folks' perspectives, previous, you know, customers that we've worked with, their perspectives that they didn't want to keep doing these e-learnings alone. Right? I mean, obviously the e-learning by its very nature is self-paced, but folks wanted to be able to discuss with other folks taking the course so that everyone's doing the quadrants lesson at the same time. And you guys have really shown up in a way that has kind of sold me on this being finding a way to become part of our offering. Certainly have to iron out some of the bugs and calibrate some of the details, but I appreciate deeply already what y'all have demonstrated through your efforts. And then let me also say that Ali, it's so fabulous to be working with you. We were laughing yesterday at Ken's, Ali and a few of us, that, you know, he's the only guy who's come into this community who's working, you know, really close right there with Ken and the rest of us, sort of a small group of Ken's senior students, who has somehow managed to avoid, you know, the 8 years of politics and stress and strife and everything that all the rest of us have gone through, you know, working at Integral Institute and then at Integral Life and then now Core Integral. And somehow Ali, in all of his mighty capacity, has managed to sort of slip right in there and work closely at the heart of it and only on the stuff that's most radically important. And he does that, you do that, Ali, with such grace and such power that it's inspiring. Maybe inspiring me to quit all my jobs and just deal with this work rather than the politics. But anyway, brother, it's good to have you here.
Likewise, and thank you deeply for the opportunity as always, Clint.
For sure, man. I wouldn't choose anyone else. That's why I didn't. All right, guys, so we're going to jump right in. I'm going to start with a question that Peggy submitted, just because it's sort of logistical and pretty easy to address. And Peggy was basically asking, so what's the deal with the completion progress box or bar that's in each lesson? She says, mine says 33.33%, but I've finished all the recordings. So that whole thing, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry about it, because my answer to Peggy and anyone who's wondering is don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. That's a feature of the site, and, you know, if we wanted, we could, if this was a totally self-paced sort of online course, I could set it so that would accurately track your progress, but that's in the context of you not making assignments and you not talking to other folks in the forums. So if you want to use that progress bar, it's for your own purposes or not. The way you would make that 33% say 100% is to scroll down to the bottom of every page, and at the very bottom you'll see an icon, and it asks you if you want to complete the lesson, and you can toggle that button on and off by clicking it. If you click it on, it'll mark that you've completed 33% of the lesson. So it's really just for your own personal tracking, but since there's only three pages in each lesson, I don't really see a need for anyone to be using it, but that's up to you. Last point on Peggy's question, go ahead and take questions like that, that are like technical, logistical, scheduling, deadlines, that kind of thing, and send them to me as a site message rather than submitting them into the Q&A call queue. Again, not a big deal. It takes 2 minutes to address a question like this, but I want to keep the Q&A call questions for content-related concerns. All right. We were then going to move to... One second here. Ali, why am I totally blinking? Oh, we were going to talk about Rob's question, which is not on my list. Rob emailed in or submitted a question, I think it was last night, and he was basically asking about the integral discourse practice, the first one on that page, and if you haven't seen that page, please go look at it. It's in the course introduction. It's the last page in that first lesson. And he's talking about the first practice in there, and it was on the term integral. And that practice, as I mentioned in the description, was advanced. It's difficult. It's unclear how to make that in a practice. It's more or less an experiment, and it required you to read the paper that I linked to, written by Zach Stein, who's incidentally also a dear, dear close friend, colleague in my research and dissertation work, a mentor at Core Integral, and someone who, if you don't know him and know his work, search him out. His work is astounding. And we oftentimes joke, as much as he hates it, we call him Ken Wilber Plan B. Actually, I'd say that Ali and him are fighting to be Ken Wilber Plan B, meaning when Ken Wilber moves on from this world, one of these guys is going to have to step up and take his place, and then and both of them have the capacity to a really large degree. So check out Zach's paper. Now, Rob has read the paper, and his question was pretty simple. He just wants an example of what we mean when we say using integral, the term integral, in a normative way and in a descriptive way. So I'm not going to spend time getting into Zach's entire argument. Please do read the paper if you're interested. But as far an example, this should make sense to you guys. If I were to say integral leadership, okay, there's a use of the term integral. I'm describing leadership. I could mean any number of things. And the reality is that I actually could mean a normative intent or a descriptive intent. And there's no way to tell unless I express that directly. So the practice is to do that expression, and that to be able to make that expression of how you're using the term, you need to then be aware of what you're doing first. So that the practice is an awareness component and then an expression component. Okay. So as an example, there's no concrete, if you use integral in a phrase like this, you're doing descriptive, right? It just doesn't work like that. So if I said integral leadership and I was using it in a descriptive way, which happens to be the way that most people use that phrase, integral leadership or integral sustainability, what I'm doing is describing, just as I would say describing the shape, size, color, texture, right, of this table that I use as a desk. Okay, I could say it's 6 feet long, it's 3 feet wide, it's black in color, it's fake wood, right? I could describe it. So when you use integral in a descriptive way, you're describing certain qualities that you're basically saying exist and define leadership. So it's things like integral leadership is only leadership from a second tier level. Well, then the problem is, what's a second tier level? And then you start to describe that using a bunch of terms in a descriptive way, and you say that second tier means A, and second tier means B, and C, and D, right? Now, Zach takes issue with that because he, particularly with the issue of levels, because we can't actually accurately describe what's up there at those highest realms because we don't really know. And when I say we, I mean we in the integral community love to act like we know, but we in the research community don't really know. The data hasn't come back yet. There's just ideas. There's not definitive, fully vetted, fully validated ways to describe integral leadership, if integral was used in that descriptive sense. Meaning, back to the table metaphor, I can definitively, without question, any one of us would agree this table is 6 feet long or however many meters, right? And we could all measure it and find out. There's no way of doing that with most of our descriptive usages of the term integral. So, Zach is suggesting not that we get rid of descriptive terms, but rather that we're aware when we use them and that we focus a little bit more energy on using integral in a normative sense. So, integral leadership in a normative sense would be me using integral to describe a type or quality or capacity of leadership where the leader's awareness is such that, for example, they recognize that every next step they take in the world, that every next action they take has the potential to sediment into the cosmos as what Ken, for example, calls a cosmic groove. Okay? And those cosmic grooves have the potential to influence the behaviors and thinking and consciousness of subsequent generations. Now, I'm not saying they always will, so don't get all narcissistic about it, but they have the potential. And the reality is that we don't know if they will or they won't. So, the normative, right, the moral, the ethical, the thing we ought to do as an integral leader is act as if our every next action might affect future generations in a developmental sense, and therefore do our best to act from our highest self. Do our best to be guided by, say, the basic moral intuition, which we'll come across more in depth in course two. Okay? So when I use integral, and I mean to imply all of what I just said, I'm using integral in a normative sense. I'm describing what ought to be the case. What is better, what is good, what is more right, what most of us would agree is more right. And if we just compare the two, which do you guys like better? Which makes you feel more hopeful for the future? This notion of integral leaders being people who can, you know, make every, you know, next behavior come from their highest self, or integral leaders as people who meet some criteria that some researcher said was second tier, that we can't even really measure that accurately. So you get the point with that example, I think, right? The idea is let's not forget these normative usages. Let's always try to be aware of how we're using the term integral, and that's the practice, the integral discourse practice. And let's try to, when possible, when we can, favor more normative approaches than descriptive. So I'm going to pause there. I'm going to turn it to Ali, let him comment on this, because we just had a brief conversation about it, and he had some really relevant, important things to say.
Right. Thank you so much. And so basically, all I want to add is this. There are ways in which I think people who are getting more and more into integral theory and people who take an active interest in integral theory are intuitively starting to get a sense that a lot of the uses of the term integral has this kind of construct looseness. So there's a sense in which the term integral is so flexible and maybe so loosely defined that it loses some sort of credibility. And this distinction of normative and descriptive really kind of hit that at the heart as well. And I just want to, before I go on any further, relate this notion to actually Troy's question, because I think this topic weaves really well into Troy's question. So I'll mention his question really shortly. And the gist of his question is that he's asking, in order to bring integral to the mainstream, should we be concerned with justifying integral theory from a basically an upper right and a lower right stance that the mainstream is mostly concerned with, and also verifying it using surfaces or mere exteriors so that it can be a tangible approach to reality that can easily penetrate the mainstream. Now, there's a couple of details in this answer that I'm going to leave to Clint, because there's a few things involved here that are just going to be really long for me to just go off on a monologue about. But the basic way I want to relate this to the previous question is that one way in which we can answer Troy's question is that there's a sense in which the term integral itself has become so overused in its normative sense that it's almost, in some senses, lost its construct validity. And so one way to remedy the issue that Troy is seeing in terms of integrals move into the mainstream is by also considering when we're using normative versus when we're using descriptive versions of the term integral. The descriptive version of the term integral, for instance, could be actually description of a structure, the function of which is the capacity to integrate multiple paradigms under a metaparadigmatic cap, basically. So that would be an account of the descriptive version. An account of the normative version, as Clint so aptly gave, is also useful in defining integral, but in some sense, when overused, it can affect the construct validity of integral theory. And I'll give just one example, and I'm sure we've actually all encountered this, and that example is, for instance, you look out into the community, and the majority of a lot of what people are calling integral approaches, integral this, integral that, are actually coming from a very normative understanding of integral theory. For instance, the majority of people who are supposedly doing integral psychotherapy are actually more concerned with describing integral in a way where they're actually touching on an integrative function of what they're doing, no matter what level they're working from, rather than an actual descriptive definition of integral itself. And I'll leave that at that point for now, and just open up the floor for Clint. Just before I do that, yeah. I do want to... Oh, go ahead, Clint.
No, please finish. I thought you were done.
Yeah, no. So just before I do that, I do want to touch on what Troy actually was asking about, in addition to just relating it to our previous question. And so something I'm foreseeing in Troy's question, and I've actually heard questions like this before, is that there's a sense in which proof, once again, requires upper right and lower right verification. And so our understanding of the validity claims actually lets us know that this is not the case. Proof does not just merely require upper right and lower right verification. I'm not saying Troy is claiming this. I'm saying this kind of fits into the question. One thing I do want to say before I let Clint take over this question is, when we talk about validity claims, just always bear in mind this isn't something clever that integral theory came up with on its own, that was inserted into ontology and epistemology as a way to justify our inclusivity, for instance. It was actually philosophers ranging from Habermas to Popper to Kant to Charles Sanders Peirce have noticed that when we ask the question, how do we know what is true and how do we adjudicate truth, there are ways in which this question is answered that are not merely in their objective form. For instance, if we want to adjudicate what is women's rights, or why is women's rights important, now we can give lower right kind of functional answers, such as in a society where women's rights are taken into consideration, that society ends up becoming more functional. But that fails to capture the essence of the moral justification behind equal rights. So there's always something irreducibly missed out on when we merely try to adjudicate for truth claims that are concerned with, for instance, normative or meaning-based or even interior-based aspects of the cosmos, when we try to account for them in merely exteriorist approaches. There's always something fundamentally lost. And before I go any further, I'll just pass it on to Clint.
That's excellent, Ali. Thanks so much for adding that. And I'll just take one step back and then step forward again in Troy's question. But Ali brings up just an incredibly important point about that recognition that normative usages of the term integral aren't always better, because they're also equally problematic. That everything in the community, in this extended community, is getting integral slapped on the front of it. And what's going on there, I think, and I've heard Ken say something similar, actually, he was talking about it yesterday, is that whatever next wave of consciousness is sort of coming down into the cosmos, integral, just as a term, with everything that it carries, it seems to fit with it. It seems to like it. People seem to jive with that. So when everyone, at the heart of it, when folks start talking about integral, they're actually, and slapping it in front of everything they do, it actually is, as Ali's saying, a really beautiful normative concern about a direction for all of us to head that is more positive, that is more holistic, that is more compassionate. And that's really, really beautiful. It also suggests that we never should choose normative over descriptive based on some external ranking of those two, of the value of both of those, that it's always context-based. And for example, in Ali's point, we would then come back and say, well, no, we want to do integral leadership as in aqual leadership, because we happen to be interested in the aqual version of integral, because we think that map has a lot of, you know, a lot to offer. So we would then say we honor that normative use of integral as in integrative and holistic and conscious leadership and conscious capitalism and all these terms you've heard, but we also want to add this descriptive component where integral means that we're working with quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types, for example. So again, as you can see, we're complexifying this because it is complex. Now, in regards to Troy's question, to switch over there, I want to say in general, this is a really important question because it speaks so truly to the normative concerns that we cannot avoid. And I said this in several places in my welcome letter being one of them. Because you're doing this work, you're part of this lineage, if I can just use that term, and you have both rights and responsibilities then, therefore. On the responsibilities side, yeah, we are a very small group of people who are committing to learn this really difficult and complex and elite map, and we have the positive and good intentions of making approaches to things that go on in the world, from leadership to sustainability to women's rights to politics, more compassionate, more inclusive, more holistic. That's a good thing. It's something we ought to do. And because you've stepped in this far, you have a responsibility, along with the rest of us, to keep moving down the road. So Troy's question is speaking directly to that responsibility. How do we bring this to the mainstream? Now, I'm prefacing it like that because we're going to return to this question throughout this course, throughout the next course, throughout this whole journey. We should always be returning to that question. And when we return to it, what we should do is take every new distinction that we learn. So now we have quadrants. This coming week we're getting lines, and we're going to get levels, and then we're going to states and types, and then we'll take a second pass in course two through all those and go to zones and methods, and we'll just keep adding on layers of distinctions because, not because we're just theoretical geeks and we like to geek out with our minds, but because we're building out a map that will help us be more compassionate, effective, holistic in the world. And to really dig into this question, we need levels. So I suggest we do return to Troy's question in the levels lesson, because when we say mainstream, what do we mean? And there's really 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 ways we can divide up the mainstream using levels as our distinction. So with 3, we could say, oh, the mainstream can be segregated into pre-modern, modern, and postmodern. Or we can say that the mainstream can be divided into the altitude colors, which again we'll learn about in the levels lesson, and which I won't get into now. And whichever one we use, and again, there's not one that's better or more right, it's about what you're using it for and what context, we then recognize that there's a version of AQUIL, and not even AQUIL as in quadrants, levels, lines, states, types, but there's a version of this normative integrative thrust that we can bring to each of those levels. But we have to adjudicate what is the best version to bring. And we actually are researching this. We're researching at what levels of development can what components of AQUIL be understood to what degree. And you've heard Ken say, if you've listened to any of his calls and interviews, that to fully or to get AQUIL, you have to be second tier. Or he says, if you like AQUIL, you probably are second tier. Now, what he's saying there is that if you can hold the general framework of how these five elements of AQUIL hang together, that you're basically calling on capacities that most likely come online in the tier that we call second tier. But what we're finding in research is that, take the quadrants for example, we can go all the way down to Piaget's formal operational, or the orange altitude, and again, there's any other names we could call it, but we can go all the way back there where people are more developmentally limited, right? Just in their capacity to take perspectives. So their thinking is called multiplistic there. And that means they can recognize that there are any number of possible correct answers or scenarios, but they're still going to strive to find the best one. And the method that's most often employed in finding the best one is the scientific, objectivistic, you know, empirical method. So again, touches on what Troy's bringing up in regards to, can we prove AQUIL using the right-hand quadrant validity claims? And what I can say is, well yes and no. And it's no, because when we're down there working at that level, we're not actually working with AQUIL in all of its glory. We're working with some version of it. Like, for example, I've taught corporate folks who I would say, you know, many of them, you could call them orange, formal, rational, sort of center of gravity. And yeah, we've taught them the quadrants. Now, they don't understand it like Ali does, but they can understand it enough to do something good with it. And when I say good, I mean, man, it's just normatively good to be able to balance interior subjective realities with exterior objective realities. And if you look in the literature, people are doing that all around the business world. Now, green level development, one higher, has been recruited to sort of bring on that awareness. But my point here is that, yes, you can bring some of these truths down to the different levels of the mainstream, but we have to figure out what are those truths? What are those versions of AQUIL? And yes, it still seems to stand that AQUIL in its entirety, holding all of it like we're all trying to do here, does require certain developmental capacities that I think most people would argue have not yet reached the mainstream. So, well, again, we'll push deeper into this when we go through levels. But for now, we have to just recognize that validity claims have to stay within their own quadrants. So objective right-hand validity claims can adjudicate truth that is objective, exterior, and right hand. And it doesn't work, you know, there's no way to prove those interior realities in the same manner, right? So you need to get people meditating if you want to show them that a certain meditative experience is real to prove it, right? And when we work with the notion of bringing something to the mainstream, we have to recognize at a minimum that the mainstream is segregated across many different levels. So from there, my computer went to sleep. Let me turn it back on here. Okay. Let me unmute you guys. I want to check in. Rob, Troy, are you out there? Did we just make a big mess of that, or did we help? let us know. Just jump in there.
This is Rob, and yeah, that helped me. I see it's more complicated than I originally thought, and there are a lot of kind of nuances there. But I think, you know, the normative versus the descriptive, how you explain that makes sense. And I guess in the article, it seemed like he was, you know, making the descriptive, he was warning against some improper uses of the descriptive for integral.
Yes.
But
he was.
I see how it could be used properly too. So that was helpful to me.
So that's excellent. I mean, I'm glad it was helpful, but you're so 100% right. In that article, for anyone who's read it or anyone who's going to read it, Zach was specifically sort of going after the descriptive use of integral to refer to capacities of later stage developmental levels. Okay? And the reason he does that is because that's Zach's work. He works at a company called Developmental Testing Services. They have some really robust developmental assessments, some of the most cutting-edge work in development that they've done all the way from the CIA to the NSA to educational institutions, just all up and down the spectrum, right? So Zach was very specifically focusing on the way we use integral in the context of speaking about developmental capacities. And in that context, yeah, we could easily argue that descriptive is a little bit more problematic than normative. What he didn't account for, and I'm actually going to pass this on to him on Wednesday, is the point that Ali made. But wait a second, Zach. There's actually a problem with the normative use. If we just look over here about how folks are using integral to describe what they're doing in this community. And I highly doubt that Zach would disagree, and he would just need to expand his argument then. The final point here, guys, for everybody, and Rob, thanks for bringing up the question, is let me just tell you straight up, by working with those distinctions and by training your awareness on what do you mean when you say integral in whatever context, and I encourage you, bring it up in your posts. Put in a little asterisk and make a little footnote and tell us what you mean by integral. You're engaging what is simply one of the most cutting-edge discussions and important discussions in the integral community. I told you what I thought about Zach. Now, that discussion, that paper, came up at the last Integral Theory conference, and it landed just beautifully well because it's right there talking about, in a sophisticated way, one of the biggest problems. And this conversation right now, Rob asking this, Ali talking about it, we've pushed that forward. We've pushed it forward. That's cool. It's really exciting. And you're being a part of that. So just wanted to say that, recognize it. Now let's see if Troy's out there. We have Troy? No, I'm hearing nothing come through. Ali, are you still hearing me?
Yeah, I hear you. And Troy had originally stated that he was not going to be on last call. I don't know if he's on this
call. Maybe
call.
Not this one either.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, no worries. We can keep moving forward, and Troy can follow up, you know, on the forums or whatnot if you'd like. Again, in short, we should all follow up on that question as we go through the course. So from here, I'm going to move, noticing we spent a good bit of time on that. I think it was fun and exciting, but there's a bunch more questions to go through. I want to wrap a few of them together, but first move into Adriana's question. Adriana is basically asking, she wants to know if the upper left refers only to the first person, thoughts, feelings, wants, desires, etc. And she references a question that we listed on one of the slides in the e-learning course. Can I ask the same questions about another individual? So that was a question we put on the screen. So we were asking you to ask yourself when doing a quadrivial analysis, ask, can I address the upper left concerns of another person? And, well, then she has a second part of the question, but I'll leave that one for a second. On this first one, the real issue here is this notion of quadrants and synonyms. And you'll notice that Ali and myself, and we've even, I think, convinced Ken a little bit more than he used to be convinced, that it's actually a little bit more productive to use very confined and specific terms to refer to the quadrants, either interior individual or upper left. Those are the ones that I choose. interior individual clearly because it refers to the two fundamental distinctions that give rise to the quadrants in the first place. Where we run into a bit more problems is to refer to the upper left too much or over-reliantly as I or self or first person. Those synonyms are just associations. You'll find that in some contexts, like when you're taking the quadrants into the boardroom and explaining them as a tool to your clients, if you're, say, a consultant, that it does help a lot to use I, we, it, and it, and its, excuse me, or self, behavior, culture, and society. But for us, here in this course, those are limiting. And Adrian is getting on to one of the limitations here. The upper left is not just first person. Now, it's the first person pronoun insofar as when I, first person pronoun, refer to how I feel, I oftentimes use the pronoun I feel happy. Okay? That's where and why we put self, first person, and I in the lower or in the upper left quadrant. But from my perspective, I can get in touch with how I feel, upper left, first person. Ali, you're out there, right? Let me ask you, Ali, how are you feeling right now? Well, I just jumped to a second person pronoun. And in relation to me, you don't have to answer that, Ali. In relation to me, Ali is a second person. Okay? So that's second person, but I'm still talking about his upper left. I want to know how he feels. And then I can say, hey, you, over there in the corner. Yeah, you. How do you feel? All right, I'm using second person again. I could say, how does he feel right now? Hey, everybody, let's look at that person in the corner. They kind of look pouty. How are they feeling right now? And you notice I'm switching to third person pronouns. But I'm still talking about the upper left. So first, second, and third person are just relationships, perspectival relationships, between the person who's talking, the person they're talking to, and the person or thing they're talking about. And then when the quadrants show up, well, it's like, hey, that person over there in the corner, what do we think he, you know, what's arising in his lower right? Right, so we could switch the quadrant, but he's still using third person terms. So those first, second, and third person associations, right, with the quadrants have to be held really lightly. And that's mostly why we don't use them very much in this course. Now, we do want to let you know that those are out there because they do have a use and they do have a facility, but they also can cause problems. The second part of Adriana's question is, what happens if we sense the feelings of another person and the person himself is not aware of them? And that, again, is radically common. So what we're working with here is, in most quadrivial analyses that involve two people or more, and I say quadrivial analyses because that's what we did as our assignment, but it doesn't have to be a quadrivial analysis. What you'll find is that over time, as you move forward through this work, you'll look out at the world and you're going to be doing a quadrivial analysis on everything. And it's not going to feel like this overly cognitive pen and paper analysis. It's just going to be the texture of how you see the world. You're going to see the world more holistically. So yes, when it comes to another person or any sort of issue that involves a relationship, what you're working with is a quadrivia on one person and a quadrivia on the other person. And both of those people also have quadrants arising as inseparable dimensions of themselves. So that actually folds over into Clement's question, which we'll get to in a second, but listen on this one. So you can take an upper left quadrivium. I'm looking through an upper left perspective. How is Ali feeling right now? And I might say he's feeling sad. And then we might ask him, Ali, report on your upper left quadrant. What do you see arising? What do you feel in your own upper left dimension? And he's, I feel angry. I'm mad. And we might totally disagree. And it's because I have a history with Ali that I kind of know his patterns and I know who he is as a person. And I know that when he, this actually should be flipped because I'm more the one that gets angry when I'm sad. So this is probably a projection, but thanks for taking it, Ali. But we're going to go with it. So I know that when Ali is angry, It's actually because he's really sad about something. And he just doesn't know what to do with the sadness. He doesn't want to face it. He doesn't want to confront it. So you could argue then, just like Adriana is saying, we have a different view of his upper left. So what we do there is not try to adjudicate which one's right or which one's more truthful or which one's better, is we recognize both. And then we say that this is really a lower left concern, that the goal here, normatively, is that Ali and I, because we work together, because we're friends, because we love each other, we want to find a way to be, you know, together in mutual understanding. But we got this crazy disagreement about mad and sad. So what we do is we just share the perspectives. I tell him what I think about his upper left and why. He tells me what he thinks about his upper left and why. And I try my best not to argue about it, because I'm recognizing that both of these views of this upper left dimension are worthwhile. And he recognizes that, yeah, even though it's his upper left and he's the only one who can actually directly experience it, making his assessment of I'm mad really, really valid and truthful using the upper left validity claim. But he also recognizes that he might have blind spots and that someone like me, who he trusts, might have something worthwhile to offer him about his own interior. So he takes it with a grain of salt and we have this conversation, and then we recognize that this our shared lower left, our shared meaning space is like, wow, we love our friendship. Using those pronouns, we love our friendship. The place where our two interiors overlap, which is the lower left dimension, which is our lower left quadrant dimension arising in this moment, man, we just love it. And mutual understanding, the validity claim of the lower left, and that understanding that we, you know, love our friendship, is satisfied. That is true. It's real because we both feel it. So that's just a quick example of what and how you can navigate, you know, what Adriana brings up about the discrepancies of your sense of someone's upper left as compared to their sense. Now, one last thing, and I'll turn to Adriana. If that other person is someone who you don't have a friendship with, that you don't know very well, that, say, is leading a meeting at work and you're making taking these perspectives, and it's not an appropriate time to discuss this issue with them, what you need to do as an integral practitioner, what you ought to do, what's normatively best to do, is hold as many perspectives as you can, you know, as lightly and fluidly as you can. Don't go with your perspective across the board as most right about their upper left just because it's yours. Just because you know best, just because they're so riddled with shadow and projections that you're most right. You have to maintain the openness to the fact that, you know, you can never really fully know their upper left. You need to discuss it with them. You need to bring it into some kind of a we space. And if you can't do that, hold an open heart until you can.